And what I'll be doing for the next few minutes is telling you a little bit about a local solution to the uninsured and to those who don't have coverage. And kind of the thought we have kind of by putting this presentation together is how are some of these local solutions going to be filtered into the national health reform? And of course, a lot of these issues are kind of pushed down to the states. And of course, like everybody, we had a state election. And so now we have a governor who used to run HCA, you know, who had billions of dollars worth of fines for Medicare fraud. And then we have a local senator who, you know, doesn't care about health reform and is put on his agenda. That's one thing he's going to repeal. So, you know, we may be challenged on the statewide kind of getting into where we need to be. I'd like to acknowledge Tom Clear. Tom Clear is our director of managed care and helped with the numbers here. And we have a big problem with uninsured in Palm Beach County, as many of you do in your communities too. And South Florida has been particularly hard hit by the economy lately. A lot of people out of work, employment rate almost 11%. And we had a baseline large amount of uninsured in the county in any case. And this probably does not include our undocumented people. You know, some of them are part of this, some of them maybe not, depending upon if they wanted to be part of the kind of studies that were done. And these come from University of Florida studies on the uninsured. But it comes up to about 350,000 people in the county with no insurance. Our local solution has been to form a tax entity, and the healthcare district was formed back in 88. So a number of these programs you're going to see today have been in effect for over 20 years. We initially were brought into being by a referendum. The voters of Palm Beach County voted the healthcare district in and gave that district the ability to tax property to use, and initially it was just two things, health coverage and trauma care. And now it's expanded to include pharmacy, and we have five pharmacies, and then we contract out to another 150, the Walgreens and CVS's. We run the aeromedical piece for the trauma systems and have two helicopters. We run the school health program. And we're going to do a presentation this afternoon about how we used our school health nurses to address the H1N1 epidemic last year. We run Hospital, and our hospital is located in Belglade. And if any of you have ever heard of Belglade, it's probably been in sentences with poverty and AIDS and various healthcare issues. And Belglade is a very rural part of Palm Beach County. It's very agricultural. And their unemployment rate is about 40%, and about 60 to 70% of the people are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. So very poor, poor area. And then we also run a nursing home. And we've based all of our coverage programs on the dollars follow the patient. So they're really based on insurance models where the patient becomes a member of one of the plans, gets a card. There's a network of providers for that specific coverage plan that member needs to go to. And we don't so much block grant hospitals or health centers or health departments to do the services. We have the dollars pretty much follow the patient. And there's four different healthcare programs that we currently do. Our biggest one is coordinated care, and that provides the richest set of benefits, and it's very close to Florida Medicaid. And we have a lot of people come and go out of our programs and Medicaid, so we try to keep them pretty similar so there isn't too much loss, particularly in things like pharmacy and formularies, so that people aren't always having to switch back and forth what inhalers they're on or that sort of thing. We also run a HMO, Healthy Palm Beaches, and that serves the TANF population, Temporary Aid to Needy Families population. And that's also regulated by the Department of Insurance. So you can't be too creative with what you do there. You know, the insurance department tells you what you got to do, what you got to offer, and that's that. We also do a maternal care program. And this allows women up to 150% of federal poverty guidelines who are not eligible for SOBRA to get their care through the system. And it's really great because we've had all sorts of issues in our indicators as far as prenatal care, and this sort of addresses that by making sure these women have access. Now, they do have to go to either the health department clinic or one of our federally qualified health centers to do that care, but it is care, and they're located throughout the county. Our newest program is Vita Health, and I'll talk a little more about that. That goes up to 300% of federal poverty guideline. It is one of these new flex plans that the state of Florida has allowed, and we call it coverage and not insurance because it doesn't provide a full range of benefits. So starting back with our largest program, coordinated care, this again mimics Medicaid, but it does have eligibility requirements. And as we've talked about some of the ways people become eligible for some of our coverage plans, this is one where people do have to provide some documentation. So we have four parts to our eligibility piece. The first is residency. You have to show that you live in Palm Beach County. Second thing is identification, and you have to have some sort of identification. Now, this is to get the full benefits for coordinated care. We also have another option for those people who can't show that identification piece, because we got so many undocumented people that we don't require necessarily people give us a Social Security card or a green card to get some services. So those folks can go to the clinics, they can do outpatient services. But to get the full range of benefits, you have to show you live in Palm Beach County, and you have to give us some identification. Then your assets, and this is where a lot of people fall out too, because the assets are $7,000 in the bank, you know, minus your house and minus your car. And a lot of people lose their eligibility or lose going forward because they have more than that in the bank. And it's unfortunate that people have to spend down assets before they become eligible for these programs. And then finally, the income is up to 150% of federal poverty guidelines. So again, for your people, you know, this is serving mostly your poor of the county. Big rich benefits, again, lots and lots of things that people are eligible for. Again, mimics Florida Medicaid. I'll just pull out a couple of the highlights here. Hospital, 45 days per year. And you know, most hospital utilization for most people is maybe 10 days tops per year, but you do have your sicker people. And I should say that coordinated care does attract those people who have chronic illness and have more healthcare needs than the general population because they weren't able to get care elsewhere, maybe not able to work, so they wind up again in this program. You've got pharmacy services there, prescriptions, you got outpatient for both primary care and specialty care, you got therapy, lab services, x-ray, vision, dental, so it pretty much is the full package of services available for people. It's costly. The medical costs have a per member per month of $330, and look at the pharmacy costs. It's a part of the medical costs. They're a big chunk of it, and so many of these people, we have a lot of cancer patients who are getting chemotherapy and expensive drugs through the system, and we work our pharmacy costs. We use our individual pharmacies that we have located in the health department clinics to access a lot of free meds, 340B pricing, access all those free share to care programs, and it's still this cost. So it's really just a costly piece of it. So your total there is $418, and then because this is the very poor folks of it, there's no premium cost. It's a few co-pays for meds, but no costs on a monthly basis for premiums. Our Vita Health is the newer kind of program, which we wanted to extend coverage to people up to 300% of federal poverty guidelines. So this was allowed under a state law a few years ago, and these are called flex plans. And you have to file your plan with the state about what you're going to cover, and they have to approve it and that kind of thing. It's called coverage, not insurance, because it does not include all those mandated requirements under the state insurance laws. So for instance, you don't have to provide transplant services, you don't have to provide dialysis, some things that would be very much in need of people, but again, they're not things that are provided by this program. It emphasizes basic health care and preventive services. So preventive services are covered, office visits to the doctors. You have to live in Palm Beach County. As far as eligibility, you have to be between the ages of 1 and 64. So of course, after 65, you're Medicare eligible, and we just don't service the newborn because most of them should be Medicaid eligible in the state. can't be eligible for other public coverage programs, and you must be uninsured for the last 6 months. And that was kind of a weird thing that the state put into the law that allowed these flex plans to come into being. And they thought there would be this great exodus of people from their, you know, employee-sponsored plan to these flex plans. So they put this six-month washout period that you had to be uninsured. We have by no means seen that. You know, people usually will stick with their insurance and, you know, only wind up on this plan when either the employer doesn't cover it or they've lost their employment. Income is up to 300% of federal poverty guidelines. And there is here's the benefits here, and there are costs for all the services. So there's copay. So you do have 10 days of hospital stay in this plan. You have emergency room, outpatient, MRI. Probably what makes it less expensive for us is that prescriptions are just generic. And so for some folks, you know, this is not a good option for them because they are on expensive meds or generic meds. But again, for many people, and this was put into place for people who are basically well, it may be a good option for them. There's also premiums for VitaHealth. You can see here that our costs are $180 per member per month, but the pharmacy costs now are only $5 per month, with just kind of going to that generics only. And then the premiums are here, and they're still pretty expensive. You know, for an adult 55 to 64, and that's kind of the group we'll talk about for the rest of the time, $125 a month. And if you have a family of four with two adults and two children, you know, you might be paying $250, another $60, you know, $310 a month. So it's not the cheapest alternative. But again, if you're not able to obtain coverage and you're below that 300% of federal poverty guideline, it's an option for people to have some coverage. So anyway, when we take a look, one of the models of expanding health care coverage was to reduce kind of the age of people that go into Medicare. Remember that model that came out, you know, not too long ago, that everybody over the age of 55 could be put into Medicare? So we thought we'd kind of use that as a model to look at expanding our coverage. So with our coordinated care, we have a population in Palm Beach County that you can see there, about 122,000 in that age. And taking that estimated uninsured, and it actually may be a little higher, because usually those folks, when they lose their job and employment, they may not be able to re-enter the workforce as quickly, so may stay uninsured longer. But we'll use that number. And using that over $5,000 per year to supply that coverage to people, you come up with about $170 million. Now, our ad valorem taxes for this coming year, because, you know, property has kind of gone down the tubes in Palm Beach County like everywhere else, and taxes are based on property rates, it's going to be about $140 million. And then we get another about 50% from third-party payers and things. But, you know, it would kind of take up all of our resources just to expand in this one group, age group, for the folks who would be uninsured. And then if we did that VitaHealth, that lower cost expansion, and use that as a model, you get a little different kind of numbers here. You got the same amount uninsured. But when you get you your per member per month, you also have a premium that they're paying. So they're using some of that to defray the cost, of course, of the program. So you get around a $25 million cost there. And of course, now the questions as we kind of go forward here is, you know, how can we use these local plans and programs to keep advancing our coverage agenda? And again, we already have this network in place and participation by all our hospitals in the county. We have 1,500 providers on the network, all the clinics, all the health department participation. It would be a shame to lose that or have to change that into some other kind of model or some other kind of system to provide coverage for people. And then how would funding change? You know, there was a lot of talk in our area, well, now that we have health care reform, we could kind of do away with that property tax that we have for the uninsured. You know, it's not going to be a problem anymore. And people are really quick to, you know, take away your funding, you know, they just want to see their taxes being reduced. And, you know, that is really hard to show people that you continue to serve folks. And then, you know, we're still talking about a large population of undocumented people. And what do we do with them, and what services do we provide with them? And then, you know, again, how can we continue to preserve and encourage these programs? Again, the state will have a lot to do with that, and our state is talking about doing health reform by regionalizing. And, of course, we use local Palm Beach County tax dollars to do local programs, and it's real hard to regionalize. When we try to do something in our hospital, which is on the west end of the county, with the county just directly west of us, we get into all kinds of trouble because nobody wants money from Palm Beach County to take care of these people over from Hendry County. That would just be a horrible thing, right? So we have a lot of issues when we go through this regionalization. If some of these monies are going to also fund administrative costs or different kind of services for people outside of our county. So anyway, those are just a few thoughts, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wiwara. Those were three excellent presentations. And before I open the floor to questions from the audience, the discussion questions that Dr. Wiwara suggested actually tie into what I was thinking. At the Health Reform Summit, one of the kind of charges, aside from that the implementation is yet to be done, is how is health reform on a national level going to impact the delivery of services on the local level? And you started talking about that, but I'd be more interested in, since you've already started thinking about it, where do you see that going?
Well, we're going to try to embrace this regionalization. So, you know, the two counties to the south of us, Broward and Dade, and that includes large public systems. There's two hospital systems in Broward, and then there's the Jackson system down in Miami. Talking about consolidating our coverage products. They have similar kind of coverage products for their populations. And that might be one way we could do that, if we can figure out kind of how to approach the state as a three-county kind of payer and provider, and that we could do these services for all these people. And that's kind of what our thinking has been, because the mandate, our state legislature is going to have a special session about Florida Medicaid. And currently about 50% of our enrollees in the state Medicaid are in managed care products, and they're going to try to push everybody else into those managed care products. And so we feel probably that's the way to go, because regionalization for all these plans, both if they're Department of Insurance regulated or not, is probably the best way we can position ourselves to be a player with reform.
Terrific. Thank you. Questions from the audience? Yes, sir. Please state your name and where you're from.
Okay. My name is Rick Beinke. I'm chair of the Public Management Department at Suffolk University in downtown Boston, right next to the State House. And for many years, I was the main evaluator of the managed care program for behavioral health in Massachusetts for 15, 16, 17 years. I also teach health policy and implementation of policy, so particularly Massachusetts folks I'm interested in. My question is this: as we've listened and we saw and heard John Auerbach on Saturday and others, Massachusetts, we had a great election. We went all Democratic, went a few states, but the focus in Massachusetts seems to be not on how you fill up that 2.7 now, but how do we move to the next phase? The talk is of how do we control costs, how do we control quality, and what you folks are talking about is never talked about. It's like we assume we can't do it. We've done the best we can. We move on. So my question is, to what extent has the work that both of you have been doing, are people hearing it in Massachusetts? Do they have any interest in it? And if so, how do you do that even as we move on, as Massachusetts says, to the next phase?
Why don't you come to the microphone, because the entire session is being recorded and we want to make sure that all the wisdom becomes part of history.
It's a very interesting question, because we, through health reform, didn't it's not universal, right? We didn't go with a single payer. We didn't get universal coverage. We're leaving out explicitly, millions of people. So I was thinking during Michael's discussion of what is the steady state? What amount of uninsurance minimum might you have to expect in a system like this? Because there's always going to be people who say, to heck with it, I don't need it. Or people transitioning, as you pointed out, or people churning on and off coverage, or people who just aren't linked into the system. So I was wondering that myself, of sort of is 2.5 to 3% sort of what you're just going to have to live with, or can you do better? And I would say some of the things you could do better are marketing. I mean, I think that there's a big push initially to get this well known, especially centered on the mandate, but public funding for marketing campaigns never lasts forever. But all you have to do is look to the private sector, and there's ads for McDonald's every single day and Coke every single day, and there's, the idea of keeping your product out there for public consumption. The community-based outreach grants that I mentioned, they're kind of pathetic, $5,000 to $20,000, a year. I mean, that's an area where I think a lot more investment could be made to help people who don't know where the coverage is or how to access it link up with community-based organizations. I think one of the real positive aspects of reform is there's lots of money going into community health centers, both for expanding new sites and building the capacity of existing sites. And I think community health centers typically are very well engaged with application assistance and getting folks enrolled. So I think that's a positive. So Michael, I'm sure you have more to add to that, but I think it's a really good question of whether, do you have to accept a couple of percentage points and argue, my talk was clearly kind of a cheerleading thing, like, look how great they've done. And you might argue that there are bigger challenges now remaining with cost and quality.
It feels like the message from the state is, we've been there, we've done that, we're on to the next phase.
Right,
and
right.
And we will tell the nation how to do the next phase, not how to finish our first phase.
And you saw how quickly the national debate was warped away from, or how quickly Democrats lost the discussion around coverage. I mean, the whole idea of covering 30 million more people with coverage is sort of, that's just a byproduct. Everyone cared about cost. That's what it should have been about. So it's interesting.
Dr. Todd?
So the question was, have we kind of moved on to cost and quality? And one of the big research things you hear now is care after coverage is kind of a big, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation, who is really instrumental in supporting the Urban Institute and others to do a lot of research to get us health reform. They now have care beyond coverage. So now that people are insured, can they get the access to the care they need? So have we moved on? I think in some ways we have a little bit moved on because we've gotten to such a low number. But the reason I did my research is because I was curious, why can't we get to zero? Can we ever get to zero, or what is the insured? And I definitely interviewed people who want to be insured. And many of them, based on my interview, I didn't do an application with them, were eligible to be insured, but didn't know how to go there. So I'm hoping that my research, one of my committee members is Nancy Turnbull. She's one of the Connector board members. The Connector is the state exchange. They have a 10 member board. Came up with a lot of big decisions, like what is minimal credible coverage? If you're going to have insurance, what is insurance? What is the affordability standards? So I'm hoping we can get this information out there. And as Ian said, it's been a one-time, it's a big push right up front. The outreach and enrollment grants that Ian mentioned were vetoed by the governor this year. And then fortunately, the Connector Authority was able to come up with some funding to continue them. So the community-based agencies will continue to get funding. One of the things I do in the Office of Community Programs at UMass is act as the grant manager for those funds. And there's 53 community-based organizations in the state who receive. They received a little bit more money than that. It's closer, I think, to 40,000, I think they're receiving this last round. But it is, it's not big dollars, but we need to continue to push those efforts and help people get enrolled. Because if not, I'm afraid we'll start seeing some slippage with the economy and whatnot, and then maybe we won't be 2.7%. Maybe next year, sir, it'll be 3% or 3.2. So as Ian said, with the advertisers always keeping your brand out there, we need to always keep the brand out there. Not just the penalties, which everyone's aware of. People know they need to have insurance. Everybody except for two people I interviewed knew about the individual mandate. But less people are aware of the positive, the carrots, the expanded coverage programs. So we've got to continue to market that.
Excellent dialogue. Next question. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Tracy Williams, and I'm the Director of Women's Health Policy and Advocacy at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And I'm particularly interested in the 2.7% or higher, depending on which survey you look at. So my question is, particularly with regard to the people who churn, as you call it, or transition on and off because of changes in their life status, their risk notes, and so on. We have this online procedure for enrolling, but for recertification annually, is that online? And there was a new initiative mentioned, and I wonder if you could comment on that. And how can we reach the people who get there in the first place, or get coverage in the first place, and then lose it? And you know, how do we keep them in the system?
Come to the mic.
I'm not, you know, we did our work nearly a couple years ago, and so I'm not aware of kind of the latest. I'd be curious to see what thought is being given to the renewal process. Generally, what you see across the country are innovations related to CHIP. CHIP maternal and child health programs tend to be the front runners in terms of simplifying coverage and simplifying enrollment and simplifying renewal these days, just because everybody politically can kind of get behind moms and kids. And what you see going on in states are things like passive renewal. In other words, the default is to keep you enrolled unless you tell the state otherwise. I've got other coverage, I've changed jobs, I've got more money. And the state, the better that information systems become, the more able a state is to check with the Labor Department to see what the person's income is, to work with the state income tax system to check those sorts of things. So I think one of the lessons from the child health community, the CHIP community, would be passive renewal. Instead of defaulting that someone is off the program when you don't see that renewal application come in. I believe that the innovation that I've heard about and my friend Stan Dorn told me about was that there is a particular employment form that is currently required. When you change jobs or change incomes, you're required to submit it to let the state know that your income has changed. And in the subsidies that we're talking about, changes in income probably aren't so dramatic that what they might move you from one subsidy category to another, but probably wouldn't disqualify you for coverage. But if you don't get that form in, you lose coverage. So again, the idea I think of what I understand is that they're moving to a more default passive system where they don't bump you off, but then follow up with you to find out more information about your change in employment status. That's all I know.
Thank you. Yes. Next question in the back.
My understanding is that with the virtual gateway, they're literally sitting down in front of a terminal helping to submit, develop, complete the application with the client and submit it right there and in there.
Yeah, there's no state.
Speak at the mic.
Some people wanted a state place to go, like the Registry of Motor Vehicles. What we've done is, as Ian mentioned, is empowered healthcare providers, hospitals, and community health centers as enrollment places to go. But we haven't done a good job to do that. I did talk with many people who showed up to hospitals and community health centers not for healthcare appointments and were able to get supports. But I also talked to an individual who showed up at a hospital not because he had needed health care, but because he heard that he could get assistance with the application, and no one at the hospital was able to help him out. And that same person went to that same hospital months later to get stitches, and they were able to help him out when he was there for a health care appointment. So, you know, we've got to do a better job of promoting it. So the places are community health centers and hospitals to get enrolled. People had mentioned, is there a physical place like the Registry of Motor Vehicles, a state office to go to? No, we've empowered healthcare providers with the Virtual Gateway, which is this won some awards. It's a very neat online tool, and they can help with the application right there. In Massachusetts, the health departments, we don't have a county system in Massachusetts. Really, the public health departments in Massachusetts are run by each town. So most town, if you go to small communities, the public health department might be one person, and they're doing everything from checking the sanitation at restaurants to other large catastrophic prevention. So our public health departments, maybe in some of the larger cities, play a role, but in Massachusetts, we've really decentralized public health to 351 different cities and towns.
Yeah, I would just say that, just to follow up, that remember the mini grants in Massachusetts started with the CHIP program. And I actually think that one of the greatest innovations to come out of the CHIP program was this growth in community-based application assistance. I mean, we've for decades talked about outreach and how important it is to get the word out about programs and whatnot, but to actually empower those same people to fill out applications on behalf of clients, I think, is so critical. And I hope that national reform, you know, takes advantage of that development. There's basically kind of two models. When we did our CHIP evaluation work, there are programs like Massachusetts where a grant is given to an organization, and then it's up to that organization to use it to build their capacity. There's also programs like in California, what they call certified application assistance, where they pay a per application fee. You know, a finder's fee, $50 a pop of every successfully completed application. And they're different incentives, but they achieve the same end in terms of giving a financial lifeline sort of to groups that want to do this. And then there are other, they're complicated layers. There are others out there like community health centers and safety net hospitals that have plenty of incentive. They don't need extra money to realize the benefit of doing applications for their clients, because the more applications they get in, the better reimbursement they're going to get, the lower the bad debt. Health plans. There are even, New York State is out there, you know, there's a real history of tension with Medicaid and health plans around letting them do marketing. Because back in the 80s and whatnot, plans would market themselves and steer people to their own plans with all kinds of false promises. But a lot of that has sort of gone by the wayside, and again, health plans are becoming more partners in enrollment efforts in New York State. There are really strict rules about not being able to market their plan, but they see an advantage to the whole system of getting folks enrolled in CHIP. So again, I think it's a matter of getting it out in the community in enough places that people interact with it or are more likely to interact with those types of enrollers.
Thank you. I just would like to comment about the issue of marketing and plans. In New York City, because there is tremendous capacity of providers who will take Medicaid or who will take the plans, the biggest problem in New York City is that if you're in a plan and you get service outside the plan, then the plan loses money because they have to pay for the service elsewhere. So it all depends on the capacity in the community on how well the plans and the marketing work. A woman here had a question. Yes. Tell us your name first.
My name is Kim Boyd, and I'm here from Denver, Colorado. I work for Tri-County Health Department, and I'm the nurse program coordinator for a program. And I'm curious.
Participation in this case, I was talking in the eligibility context, not the participation in the healthcare system context, just to clarify. So typically you calculate a participation rate of, you know, we made this many people eligible for the program, and then of those, how many are actually enrolled? And I think that's one of the chronic challenges that face public coverage programs in this country, the way they're designed, is that you make gobs of people eligible, but if you're to the extent that your eligibility system is full of barriers, your participation rate will be crummy. So I think in Massachusetts, they've taken all these steps to improve that penetration rate, that participation rate. And I'm not even sure if I know exactly what the number is, but I think the whole other issue then is once you've got coverage, does it translate to access? And I think that's a huge challenge that remains. Did you want to add anything to that?
Sure. So people who join Commonwealth Care, the subsidized state program below 300% of the federal poverty level, get enrolled in one of five managed care plans, which are the same managed care plans that the state uses for their Medicaid program. So if you're in Commonwealth Care, you have similar access to the same type of provider networks. I would say in Massachusetts, our Medicaid provider network overall is pretty good. There may be pockets of regions in the state where there's less access. And for certain specialties, there may be some less access. But overall, all the major hospitals in Massachusetts are accepting Medicaid, and there is pretty good coverage of providers. So people who are on these programs are getting access to a pretty robust provider network. Again, there may be some in Berkshire County, out in Cape Cod, there may be some shortage areas, but overall, I would say it's pretty robust coverage.
Next question. Over here. Oh, and yes, in the back. Thank you.
My name is I'm a consulting practice from Rochester.
Could you speak up just a little?
I'm sorry. I run a consulting practice from Rochester. Have you heard me?
Yes.
Right. The Palm Beach experience reflects some of the challenges we face in New York State. We have a large Medicaid program, growing body to the state, high taxes. Ask anybody on the street, how do you reduce taxes? They'll tell you, cut Medicaid spending. But in Massachusetts, it seems like you have actually expanded the Medicaid program. And I'm curious, how have you been able to do this without invoking voter impact? What has been the impact on taxes particularly? The other question, you have a simplified application process and a single state agency that is administering the program. That implies some efficiencies in terms of administrative costs. How large have these things been compared to what you have before? And is this a model other states should be considering seriously?
So if I can repeat your questions to make sure we understand them. The first one is, how do you deliver this program in a high tax state without increasing taxes? And the second question had to do with the simplification of the enrollment process and the administration of the simplification. Okay, great.
So where do we come up with the funding to insure all these people? Well, one of the things that Ian mentioned is we had an uncompensated care pool. So we already had some dollars in the system. And then we created some more dollars through the penalties, which were relatively small. But we have a 1115 waiver. Our Medicaid program has a waiver. So all the people who are enrolled in the Commonwealth Care program, we are getting our federal match, our Medicaid match that we have. But there was still new state dollars that had to be put into this program to make it successful. And we have had taxes raised. Our sales tax in Massachusetts this past year went from 5% to 6.25%. So we have had to raise taxes in Massachusetts to cover this. Not just this, but all healthcare, all kind of government spending in total. So we did have to put new state dollars to make this work, but we already had a pool of funds available through our uncompensated care pool that we were running that we redirected towards health insurance as opposed to paying for health care directly to safety net hospitals. And the second question was around...
It had to do with the simplification of enrollment.
The simplification of enrollment.
Consolidation in the state, the single state agency.
Yeah, I mean, we have a kind of authority which runs the Commonwealth Care Program, but it is a separate program than our Medicaid program, MassHealth. So we don't necessarily... I mean, we have a single entity that runs Commonwealth Care, Commonwealth Choice, and a connector board that came up with the rules around affordability and minimal credible coverage, but we still run that separately than our Medicaid program. What we did do, which was mentioned, is we've created a single application. So you apply for one application, and the state will tell you what's the most robust benefits you're eligible for, whether that be on the Medicaid side, which we call MassHealth, or on the Commonwealth care side, or if neither, if you're eligible for the uncompensated care pool. What we have left out, though, is the medical security plan, which is the health benefits you receive when you're collecting unemployment benefits. That's a separate application. Some of my interviews, I saw people getting dropped off, moving back and forth between Commonwealth care and the medical security plan, and then back over, because those are separate application process. So we do have a separate entity for Medicaid and the rest of the health insurance reform products, but we have created a single application.
Let me just say a few words about eligibility in Palm Beach, because a lot of our population is not able to fill out an application, and probably this is kind of where some of those issues about how many places do you have where people can go to seek help. And so we try to deputize as many agencies in town as we can as our community partners, so that folks can go there, so they can go to the federally qualified health centers, the health departments, our free clinics, some of the schools that run after school programs we have community partners with, because our population generally is not able to go through even simple applications. The literacy level is quite low, even for our higher products. Now, we have an eligibility staff that makes the final determination on everything, but having so many partners, we're kind of able to get out there. And we've struggled with how to get people in. We've had navigators in the past, we've had peer educators, we've had lots of different folks out in the community to try to work with the eligibility piece, so that people don't wind up in that ER who are eligible for your services without ever having been qualified. But I don't think we have any answer to that problem.
Thank you very much. Last question. Can you speak up just a little bit?
I don't know the answer to your question necessarily. I think my notion is that at this point they haven't changed much. That there was certainly insurance regulation that I know little about. So maybe Michael can talk to that. But I think, you know, now that the enrollment piece hasn't been completely taken care of, but has been implemented to an extent where there's only 2.5 to 3% uninsured, I know that the state is really moving to this cost and access and quality sort of emphasis. And one of the things I was reading about actually just last week was the notion that the governor's, I don't know the formal name of the commission, but a cost commission is beginning to look at global payment sorts of strategies to try to move the entire system, public and private payers, away from fee-for-service, which is inherently inflationary, to a more you know, sort of capitated global sort of payment, bundled payment system.
I would just add that Chapter 58 of the Acts of 2006, which created Massachusetts health reform, if you think about access, cost, and quality, only took care of access. We increased more people, and despite how difficult it is, that's easy to do. If you can throw enough money, you can get enough people coverage. We passed Chapter 305 of the Acts of 2008, which was a bill around cost and quality. Some people called it Health Reform 2 in Massachusetts, and they threw lots of things in that, from drug gift bans for pharmaceutical reps to creating this quality and cost council. So we've kind of tackled this second. We've taken a two-pronged approach in Massachusetts, get people access, and then second, we've tried to tackle cost and quality. And I don't think we've figured out the answer, because we threw lots of things in that bill around technology, like I said, the drug gift bans. But I think one of the differences with national health reformers are trying to tackle more of these things simultaneously than we did in Massachusetts, where our first bill was just purely access.
Let me add two quick things that may help you on that. One of which is, during the negotiations for it, a big part of it was, what are the rates? And there was lots of negotiation back and forth with the HMOs, with the insurers. One of the keys was, the insurers were part of this from the start. They did not come in later, and in the end they worked out to have a middle kind of ground. And then this past year the insurers came back and said, we want these big rate increases, and the governor took a stand and said, no, and we won't let you keep continuing unless you reduce those. In the end, with virtually every one of the insurers, they come back and work the new middle ground on that, which is now then leading to this new commission, which they are part of, and in the next see what comes out of that in terms of global budgeting and that whole piece. So it, that whole thing, it was a major, could have blocked the whole thing again. Thankfully, there's a long history of people in Massachusetts working together. This is really health reform vibe, if you look at the history of health reform in Massachusetts. And I think that, again, is one of the reasons we were able to pull it off.
Great.
I want to thank you all. I want to thank the panelists for excellent presentations. And